Welcome to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. Today we're going to talk with Mark Sundin about his book, Delusions and Grandeur, Dreamers of the New West. It's out from University of New Mexico Press. Mark Sundin is the author previously of The Unsettlers, The Man Who Quit Money, The Making of Toro, and Car Camping. And in these new and selected essays, he recounts two decades of political activism, outdoor exploration, and curiosity. What brings the book's themes into focus is the cast of idiosyncratic people he meets. Using first-person reportage, storytelling, and humor, his observations illustrate what everyday life is like for people in the contemporary American West. Mark Sundin is a contributing editor for Outside Magazine. His work has appeared in the New York Times, The Believer, National Geographic Adventure, McSweeney's Best American Essays. He was raised in Hermosa Beach in Manhattan Beach, California, held the Russo Chair in Creative Writing at University of New Mexico, and now teaches at University of Montana. Mark Sundin, thanks for joining us.
Tom, thank you so much for having me.
So you're a resident of Utah, at least part of the year, right? Moab?
I am. I moved to Moab in 1993, and I was there working as a river guide and a dishwasher and a hourbound instructor in the canyons for about 11 years. And then I've been back and forth ever since. Currently, I'm based in Montana, but I still have my little trailer down there on a dirt road near Moab. So I'm there once a year.
So I want to take you back a little bit to your bio. Grew up in California, right?
Yep.
What you write in your introduction that you, at least about the time you went to college, you were heavily influenced by Camus. You were a a kid, not necessarily rock climbing, but in your head, I guess.
Yeah, I was probably had an outsized brain at the time, and not much experience in the world, growing up kind of in the suburbs and reading a lot of books. And I took to calling myself something of an existentialist, though at the age of 15 or 16 I probably didn't even know what the word meant. But I was always interested in the idea that there is some bigger, more exciting, more meaningful life outside the confines of suburbia. And in my particular case, I did not solve that conundrum being an English major in a college. And so after that was when I hit the road, and that's when I ended up in Moab as a 22-year-old.
Mm-hmm.
And I picked up the hitchhikers. Mm-hmm. I was out in Colorado and they wanted to go to Moab. And then the road, I said, well, I'll drop you guys off at this highway near Grand Junction because I'm going to go somewhere else. The place I got to, the road was closed. I was heading up towards Vernal. So I turned around. The hitchhikers were still there. This is over by Fruta. I picked them up again, and I brought them to Moab, dropped them off, and ended up staying 11 years.
Amazing. What were you going to do in Vernal? That's my hometown.
Oh, is it? I was going to try to get a job at Outward Bound. That was where their base camp was, or actually in Jensen, which, of course, most listeners might not know Jensen. It's a, you know, the bedroom community outside of Vernal. And but that road was closed. I ended up 3 or 4 years later getting that job, but not that time around.
Yeah, yeah. So what I think as a kid you were... You were not enamored with California. At a certain point, you began to see it. I can't remember how you put it. A kind of an artificial imitation of the authentic West.
Yeah, I mean the combination of being in a suburb, but also being in a suburb of LA, which is of course so rooted in Hollywood and make believe. And you know, I could go also into the ecology of a metropolis. Metropolis of 20 million people in a place where there really shouldn't be very many people because it's a desert, right? And so you've got this artificially watered city. Everything is built for people in cars. There's a certain sense of alienation of driving around in freeways and streets all day. So yeah, I really chafed at it, and I said I got to get out of here. It felt like I was living in the Truman Show, if you remember the Jim Carrey.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, where he's the only one who doesn't know that
Exactly.
That he's the main character, right? It's all artificial. Yeah.
Right.
You got a kind of a kid trapped in your head, right? As we said, there was a professor, and you ended up at Stanford, I think, right? You describe him as a wood chopping fellow. He suggested, hey, you ought to do some manual labor.
Yeah, this is a writer by the name of Fred Haefele, and strange coincidence that you're bringing him up today, because he just released his new book and had his launch party just 2 days ago. So I was able to go see him. And it's great. You know, he's over 80 now, and he's still writing. And I was actually honored. He asked me to write a blurb for his book. It's called The Essential Book of Pickup Trucks. It's like a memoir told through all the trucks. Anyway, he was a professor at Stanford at the time, and I had loved being in his class, and asked what I should do afterwards. And I think he kind of sensed that maybe I was a little too much in my head, had maybe more ideas than experience. And that was when he suggested, why don't you go and try some manual labor? And of course, he'd been a tree surgeon his career, mixed with being a writer. So that's what I did. I ended up in being a house painter and a river guide. And, a river guide is kind of manual labor. You're rowing a heavy boat all day. It's also kind of the service industry. You're taking care of people and serving them. But most importantly, it was outside, and it was not in a classroom or an office. And that's what brought me to Utah, and I just fell in love with the place, and I still am in love with the place. Mm.
What were you looking for, do you think? Of course, this collection spans, many years, and as a young person, you probably didn't even know exactly what you're looking for. That comes with clarity, right? And that appears in some of these essays. But what did you think you were looking for?
I'd say that at the time I was looking for a meaningful life or an authentic life. And, when you're young and you live inside your own imagination and your own head, like, it seemed like that was an external quest, that I had to go out and find that. You know, now that I'm in my 50s, I see that I probably could have found that authenticity by looking inward. I just wasn't emotionally mature enough to do that. And so when I sort of put this collection together, as you mentioned, it spans 20 years. And it's, I think the earliest piece was published in 2000, the latest in 2020. And as I started to reread these pieces, I saw that, like, I just wasn't able to access my own soul or spirit at the time. And so I would go out and find these people to interview and profile and write about, who were telling my story in some way or another. And of course, it led me to some very idiosyncratic characters. You know, there's the guy that blasted the hole in the hole in the rock house down there south of Moab. There's a Jack London impersonator. There's a Elvis impersonator and his wife, who they're out there in the casino in Wendover. And, like, you know, obviously the theme between these three is, like, people who had grand ambitions of being a great artist, and their reality was not quite as grand. And they were, doing their own, living their own vision and pursuing it. They had no significant audience. And that's what I felt like as a young guy in my late 20s, trying to be a writer and living in total obscurity in a trailer in Moab. So I could really identify with those guys and let their story be mine.
What was the common theme? I guess the authenticity you were seeking for, these people all had that?
Yeah, this is back in the late 90s, and I just thought that all of pop culture was garbage and phony and, corporate. And I just loved these guys who were making their art in a complete vacuum, whether that was the casino in Wendover or the sculptor down who ended up blasting the hole in the rock house. They had this vision of, I know what my art is, I'm going to do it, and I don't care if I get an audience. And so I found them to be oddly authentic.
Mm-hmm. Of course, another example, you wrote a whole book about this, The Man Who Quit Money, right?
Yeah, this is a book that I wrote much later, but it really took on those same themes. And this is a book about Daniel Suelo, who was a guy I knew in those early days in Moab, who then went on to, I guess you'd call it a spiritual quest, and decided to try to live like the prophets in the Bible and other holy texts, and he decided to live on faith alone. So he stopped using money and ended up in a cave as not exactly a hermit, but a bit of a holy man, you might say. And again, like I guess sort of like the other people I just mentioned, he was just considered to be kind of crazy or a nut by people around him. And the more I talked to him and read what he was writing, I said, no, here's someone who's really fascinating. Here's someone who actually has a vision for a meaningful life and actually doesn't care what the rest of the world thinks about him. And that was really beautiful to me, and of course compelling as an author.
When I think of some of these people, I don't know if you, I probably do make connection readers as well to Thoreau, right? Who kind of
Of
went back and
course.
forth, but you know, he went out to find his own life.
Yeah, I mean, Thoreau has been an inspiration to Suelo and to me. Now that I'm a professor of environmental literature, I do teach Thoreau a lot, and he's one of those authors that everyone has poked holes at or poked holes in and said, hey, look, he didn't even stay in his cabin for more than a couple months, and hey, look, he carried his laundry into town so his mom would wash it. And these things are all true. He was not actually the rugged self-individualist that people promote him to be. But then again, his writing still resonates. His writing about finding the authentic experience, and his essay on civil disobedience, that still resonates with college students, whatever, 200 years later. So that's pretty great.
The title is Delusions and Grandeur. I mean, we all engage in this some form of delusion, right? But it seems like some of the folks you talk to has to be some form of delusion to, or maybe that's just a judgment we're imposing upon them to go so far out of convention, right? Not caring what people think, they're pursuing. Is it delusion, or what are they pursuing?
It's one of those things. It depends how you look at it. You can look at some of these people and say, what a fool, like, what a failure. Or I chose to look at them like, wow, there's someone who actually, had a vision and carried it through. And I don't think they're that different than Thoreau in that sense. The grandeur part of it, of course, is that all of these people I write about are living in these spectacular landscapes of the West. And I guess one of the premises of the book is that that's not a coincidence, but rather that being in around these canyons and cliffs and mountains sort of can inspire us to think that we can be eternal and timeless, and we can be as big as these landscapes. And the results are mixed.
Do you think you were trying to outrun your former self by going out into the wilderness, and can you do that?
Yeah, I was definitely trying to outrun the self. That I thought was just too bookish and neurotic and stuck in my head and book smart. And I did successfully outrun it for a decade or two. But a lot of people who try that just end up dead, right? When you look at the sort of most famous recent example would be Christopher McCandless from John Krakauer's book Into the Wild, who just absolutely wanted to outrun himself and then went out in a blaze of glory and ended up freezing to death in Alaska. But if you don't kill yourself in this quest to leave society behind, then you grow old, and then you figure out, yeah, you still got to deal with all of these these things. And so in my case, like here I am, a college professor, having thought I would never set foot in a university again when I was 22 years old.
One of the quotations, at the main quotation at the front of the book, is from Robin Wall Kimmerer, who said, "The land knows you even when you are lost." So, I guess there is that possibility, right, of finding yourself out there.
Yeah, and people obviously go on this kind of, young people especially, go on this quest to escape who they think they are, who they don't want to be. And they can go all types of places. They can go to cities. They can go to foreign countries. They can try to sail around the ocean. In my case, going to southern Utah, there's just not a landscape that I know of that feels like it forms a sort of animate connection with people. And this is ironic, of course, because now there's a billion people going to these places that Edward Abbey described as places of solitude. And they're all trying to get this experience. But there's something about the scale of those southern Utah canyonlands, and the fact that there's water, and there's cottonwood trees, and there's mountains. It's not as bleak as the Mojave Desert. It's not as massively intimidating as the Grand Canyon. It's sort of a landscape where you can wander around and feel almost embraced by the land, and feel an animate or a spiritual connection to the land. And so that's why Moab has always attracted, I think, so many kind of spiritual seekers and pilgrims, because there's a way of just wandering off 5 minutes from a trailhead or from a road, and feeling like there's you have a connection to creation in a really profound way.
There's interesting, you talk about authenticity in yourself, right? But there's a whole debate and struggle over what the authentic experience of the West is, right? And as more and more places cater to tourists and adventure, they're selling an experience, which they're selling is authentic, but many don't feel like that is authentic.
Yeah, and this has certainly changed since the 90s when I arrived. I mean, the commodification of that experience is a huge business now. And, it's not just like there's a couple dude ranches, maybe the way there were 100 years ago, but there's all these people going down there to go canyoneering, mountain biking, four-wheeling, hiking, rafting, and the selling point is often solitude and spiritual rejuvenation. And it's quite ironic, that Edward Abbey was the big the voice who first said that, the desert is not a wasteland. The desert is a place of spiritual or aesthetic connection. And he wanted to keep everyone out. And the irony is that his books, probably more than any other person's books, brought millions of people to the desert. I was one of them. I showed up with a copy of an Ed Abbey book in my back pocket, saying like, I need to see these places. I need to get on Desolation Canyon and see what it's like to float on a river where there's no signs of humanity for 100 miles. I don't know how Abbey would respond to this today. I mean, I think he'd be so heartbroken by unintended consequence of his own beautiful articulation of that beauty.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's funny. I'm kind of struck by the teenage Mark Sundin that you described, this Camus loving teenager that heads over to Stanford. You said it was all European intellectuals or bust, right? At that point, you wouldn't have gone for Ed Abbey.
No, I thought that Ed Abbey was too straightforward and easy to understand, and said practical things. That was not my what I was into. I wanted complicated, morose, philosophical conundrums, and he didn't really present those at the time. It wasn't until later that I really was captivated by him.
Well, let's take a break. We'll come back much more with Mark Sundin. His new book is called Delusions and Grandeur, Dreamers of the New West. It's out and available now. Before we go to break, Mark Sundin, an event, you say, in Moab, May 30th?
May 30th at Star Hall, and this book will be with a pair of other desert writers, Craig Childs and Amy Irvine. And I don't know the time off the top of my head, but it'll be co-sponsored by the Moab Public Library and Back of Beyond Books. So if you reach out to either of them, they can tell you the exact details.
All right. All right. You can show up and interact with Mark Sundin. We'll have more following this break.
What is jazz? Jazz is as varied and diverse as Utah itself. It has high peaks and low valleys. It can be glossy. It can be gritty. It can be lush, it can be very sparse. It can rush like a river or flow like a calming stream. And it is rooted in tradition while always embarking on new directions. I'm John, your host for The Edge of Jazz, Sunday nights at 10 on Utah Public Radio.
Southern Utah friends, you're invited to join Utah Public Radio on Thursday, May 8th for a special party and fundraising event at the Bitten Spur in Springdale. The evening will include a catered Bitten Spur dinner, live music by Greg Eistock of Three Hat Trio, and a Q&A with our special StoryCorps guests. $75 tickets are available now at upr.org, and sales support UPR's Rainy Day Fund as we face uncertainty for the future of federal funding, aging infrastructures, and other challenges. That's upr.org for tickets.
You're listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. My guest for the hour today is Mark Sundin, author previously of The Unsettlers, The Man Who Quit Money, The Making of Toro, and Car Camping. The new book is Delusions and Grandeur, Dreamers of the New West. That's out and available now. So Mark Sundin, I'd like to have you tell me about a few of these people. I'm fascinated by this Jack London impersonator. Tell me a bit more about him.
Yeah, this is a guy out in California who had spent most of his life working in the hardware store, and just as a sort of hobby, just absolutely loved Jack London and all of his books. And as it turns out, Jack London is basically considered the most well-known, popular American author if you get outside of the U.S. You know, if you go to Russia, if you go to Vietnam, if you go to Eastern Europe, like he is considered the emblematic author up there with Mark Twain or Ernest Hemingway. Here he's been kind of forgotten. I've you know, went through all my years of schooling without ever having been assigned one of his books, and so there's a bit of a snobbery and then a reaction to that snobbery, where there's this cottage industry of guys like Mike Wilson who love him and think he should be honored. And so he took it upon himself to start dressing up like Jack London and doing these public events. And he would do soliloquies and, you know, interact with, it was often at kids' events at schools. Sometimes it would be at museums or at state parks. And he'd just gone really deep into this. He talked about it as like a spiritual connection that he had, that he felt like he was kind of, the Jack London spirit would enter his body and he would sort of channel him. And of course, you know, there's one of those things where you could see either way. You could say, wow, this is beautiful and profound, or you could say, wow, this guy's really deluded and no one cares about Jack London. And the piece I wrote really tried to walk that line and let the reader decide if how to take this guy's obsession with Jack London.
A very poignant essay is called Why Noah Went to the Woods. This is Noah Pippin, Iraq War veteran who went missing while hiking in a wilderness area of Montana. So is this, and you had to piece this together because he's missing. What did you find out about Noah Pippin? Why was he out there?
Well, I would say, first of all, that a good chunk of this book is related to the Iraq and Afghanistan wars. You know, I was involved in the anti-war movement, and I was involved with the Howard Dean presidential campaign that was the only anti-war candidate. And then I was interested in the aftermath of the war and the people coming home. So that time I was living here in Missoula, and this guy's picture ended up in newspapers because he was missing up in the Bob Marshall Wilderness, which is one of the most remote places in the lower 48. And I became absolutely obsessed with this mystery, and so I started writing about it. And Noah had done some tours of combat in Iraq, and he'd come home and he'd clearly been changed, though he never got any sort of diagnosis, as very common. If you get a diagnosis, it sort of makes it hard for you to get a job, and it makes it hard for you to move on in life. He became a police officer in LA, and this was not to his liking. This was something that he found sort of morally difficult. He had hoped that being a police officer would be something like being a samurai warrior, where you would know right from wrong and you would be on the side of the right. And instead, he found himself just arresting the same people day after day for very small, unimportant things. And he got discouraged. He didn't like the bureaucracy. And then he left a trail of confounding clues. He didn't tell anyone where he was going. He had re-enlisted in the National Guard for another tour, which for a Marine, this was like a huge step down, right? To join the National Guard was like going to Disneyland after being a combat veteran in the Marines. So he signed up to go back into the Guard, and then the days leading up to when he was supposed to arrive, he instead rented a car, drove it to Kalispell, Montana, left it at the airport, got a taxi to a hotel, and then started walking and didn't tell anyone what he was doing, didn't leave any notes or anything like that. His laptop was never found, and his parents were completely in the dark until he didn't show up to the National Guard. So they called the family and said, "You know where he is?" And they didn't know where he was. So I was then a part of a hunt in a place called the Chinese Wall. Got on a helicopter with some National Guardsmen, and we searched for his remains. At this point, it had been 6 or 8 months since he'd gone missing. We didn't find anything, and then winter came early, and so the search was called off. And then the family started getting hints that he might be alive, living under a fake name, living in Mexico. So I kind of became close with the family trying to solve this mystery. And I won't reveal how it all turns out, other than to say that like the effects of a war as distant as Iraq were felt back here at home in really profound ways, both by the people who went to the war and people who did not go to the war.
Those reverberations carry on, don't they? You write, "The war is officially over now, but it wanders our woods, haunts our dreams, and occupies our prayers."
Yeah, and everyone I met who had met Noah on this path felt a sort of profound connection to him. They felt like that he was wounded. They felt that he needed help. They felt that he was carrying the burden of so much on his shoulders. And they also felt that he was out of reach, that he wouldn't accept any help from anyone. For example, there was a family with two kids who was out backpacking. They were the last people to see him. And he wandered into their camp. He had basically like a plastic rain poncho, a very small pack, I think like a gallon jug of water in his hand, and a pistol on his waist. And they said, "Hey, there's a huge storm coming. You don't really look like you're that prepared. Do you want to stay here?" And he said, "No, I'm just going to go up here and I'm going to keep wandering." And that's sort of where that mystery begins.
You talked with one of his comrades, right, Matthew Trigo,
Yeah.
who I guess assisted in the search, and you say would continue to try to look after his men after the war. This is what Trigo told you. He was searching, talking about Noah Pippin, he was searching for peace and couldn't find it. So he went to the wilderness where there's nothing to rebel against. You can't rebel against nature. It's interesting, his Trigo's insight.
Yeah, and again, that's one of that statement that, that Trigo made. That could have been made about me, right? That's what I was doing in my 20s. And so this is another person whose own quest resonated with me. Like, I didn't go to the war, but I certainly had that feeling that that if I could get away from civilization and be in nature, that I would find peace or that I would find meaning. And that's, again, why I, one of the reasons I was so drawn to write about Pippin.
You had a couple of essays talking about the attempts to stop the Dakota Access Pipeline. You know, it was a big movement. Tell me a little bit about that. What did you most take from those essays?
Sure. Those essays came at a time when I was very cynical about the, or at least discouraged by the environmental movement. It felt like we had basically white people on both sides of the argument, arguing about how to take care of the land. And when I went to Standing Rock, so this is Standing Rock, North Dakota, the Sioux Reservation, I found a movement that was completely led by Native people. It was foremost a spiritual movement. It was led by prayer, and it was really different than any other kind of environmental protest that I've been a part of before. And one of the reasons was, I mean, in addition to the spiritual aspect, is that it was a history lesson for those of us who were non-Native, for whom, you know, these treaties seem like ancient history. The dispossession of Native people and the broken treaties and the Allotment Act and the boarding schools, these are very fresh in the, as if they just happened yesterday and for Indigenous people in America. So instead of saying like, we're going to stop this pipeline because of you know, a threat of getting chemicals in the drinking water, which was part of it, they said like, we are a sovereign nation who have been the victim of genocide for 400 years, and it stops here. And, you know, this pipeline with the potential of poisoning everyone's drinking water was just one more chapter in a long saga. And that resonated with me personally to feel those other elements, you know, not just the scientific element, but the historical, the religious, the cultural, the social justice. And it also resonated like around the globe. And, you know, we had members of, I think, every federally recognized tribe came, plus Indigenous people from other countries, plus, you know, thousands of non-Native people who came just to be supportive, to work behind the scenes in the kitchens and chopping wood, to like keep this camp alive for 6 months so that they could do this direct action to stop this pipeline.
Interesting. You point out in your notes at the end that this effort might have seemed futile, but Native peoples and other peoples kind of found their political footing based in this movement, right? Deb Holland.
Absolutely. I think ultimately, you know, the tribe and the movement was defeated. First they won. They've actually, then the last months of the Obama administration, Obama agreed to change the route or to stop the pipeline. And, you know, did just a little background for those who don't know, the pipeline was supposed to go upstream on the Missouri River from the town of Bismarck, which is 90% white. And, you know, the white environmentalists said, we don't want this thing above our town. It could poison us. And so the Army Corps of Engineers and the Dakota Access Pipeline Company said, okay, we'll put it downstream from Bismarck and we will put it upstream from the Native people's reservation, which is, of course, in a classic example of environmental racism. So anyway, as soon as Trump was elected, he overruled, and the pipeline was then built, and it's now pumping oil, and it's the courts have decided that it was illegally built and that it shouldn't have been built. But of course, when it's pumping $1 million of oil through it on a daily basis, it's hard to shut the thing down. So who knows what will happen. But yeah, in the process, it was the largest gathering of Native American people since maybe ever, but certainly since Little Bighorn. And all these tribes that had feuds sort of resolved them during the Standing Rock occupation, like it's not occupation, but uprising. And yeah, people like Deb Haaland attended and then went on to run for Congress and then became the Secretary of Interior and then now running for governor of New Mexico. Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez went as a water protector and then decided to run for Congress after that. And there has just been this incredible flowering of political power and artistic achievement, including having Joy Harjo as the U.S. Poet Laureate, having, you know, Reservation Dogs as this great television show, the first to be totally written and directed and acted by Native people. Numerous other authors have won major awards and come to prominence. And so it's a huge renaissance of Native thinking, creativity, and I would argue a lot of it came about through what happened at Standing Rock, that sense of empowerment and purpose.
It's very interesting to me to compare this these essays on Standing Rock to another essay set in North Dakota. You went to look at people who are involved in the drone industry.
Yeah,
it couldn't get different vibes. I would imagine the two.
No, these might be the two. These essays take place in North Dakota, and they might be the most different in terms of tone. The Standing Rock pieces are quite serious and really plumbing the depths of American history and injustice. And then the drone piece might be the funniest in the book. So I was sent by Popular Popular Science or Popular Mechanics? I don't remember. I was sent by a magazine to write a story about the drone industry in North Dakota. And it was a small culture of startups with a lot of military and federal backing to create something like the Silicon Valley of drones in North Dakota. And I was uniquely unqualified to write this story because my past as a anti-war activist, as someone who doesn't really trust the military to always act in the benefit of American citizens, and also just kind of a technophobe. I'm a little bit of a Luddite, as a late adapter of most technologies. And I went up there and found this incredibly friendly culture of really nice guys, both in the military and law enforcement and technology and startups, who could not even imagine why someone would not welcome the advent of, you know, drones in their neighborhoods. They would say things like, "Well, if you're not doing anything wrong, what do you have to hide?" I mean, and when I would raise my objections about privacy and about rights, like, they would look at me like I was a complete lunatic. Like, so it was funny. These people were so nice. They were so friendly. They were so welcoming. And I found the technology that they were supporting to be so sinister in some ways. And so that's why that piece actually ended up getting rejected by the magazine, or I should say I was forced to do a major rewrite to the point I didn't like the story anymore, but I was not in a position to, I needed the paycheck at that point. So when this collection came about, I was able to go dig into my archives and find the original draft, which I said, this is what I wanted to say about this. And so that's what ended up in the book, which is really fun.
Let's take another break. We're talking with Mark Sundin. His new book is called Delusions and Grandeur, Dreamers of the New West. So Mark Sundin, tell us again about this event in Moab.
I will be in Moab on May 30th with the two other authors who I love. That's Craig Childs and Amy Irvine, and we'll be speaking at Star Hall, and that's in conjunction with Back of Beyond Bookstore and the Moab Public Library.
All right, we'll have more with Mark Sundin following this break.
On the next Putumayo World Music Hour,
we celebrate Cinco de Mayo with a musical fiesta from south of the border.
Tengo que confesar que a veces no me gusta tu forma de ser.
I'm Dan Storper.
And I'm Rosalie Howarth. Join us for Cinco de Mayo, the next Putumayo World Music Hour.
That's Thursday night at 10 here on Utah Public Radio.
I'm Maria Hinojosa. Next time on Latino USA, the fight to defend the legal status of Venezuelans in the United States.
I felt that all these years of advocacy were just prep time for this.
That's next time on Latino USA.
Tune in Tuesday morning at 11 here on UPR.
You're listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams, and we're talking with the author Mark Sundin. His new book is called Delusions and Grandeur, Dreamers of the New West, and that's out and available now. A great read. So Mark Sundin loved your essay on tiny houses called Tinier Than Thou. Laughed quite a bit in this one. So Tinier Than Thou, there, you went to a convention, I guess, or a collection. And I think there is some competition, right? Who can get the tiniest? Who's the most authentic tiny house owner?
Yeah, this movement was right up my alley. This is, of course, people who are building these, 50 or 100 square foot homes that they put on trailers and haul around. And what interested me, of course, was that it wasn't just about the material possession of a small residence. It was about this kind of spiritual quest, like Thoreau, to suck the marrow of life by shedding yourself of everything unnecessary. And if you could live in, 100 square feet, then that was great. And if you could live in 50, then that was even greater, apparently. So I struck out to the, and as someone who lived in a 10 by 57 trailer in Moab for a lot of my life, I could really relate. Like, I had lived in a somewhat tiny, tiny house on wheels, and I really loved it. So I set out to a convention in Colorado Springs, to where all of the big names in this movement were getting together. They called it a jamboree. And, as with anything in America, I think that a lot of that valid and interesting spiritual driving force had been replaced by marketing and gimmicks and people trying to sell you some junk. And so I found a great mashup of those two different visions of America at this fairgrounds in Colorado, where you had these like real spiritual pilgrim types, and then people who were just trying to get a contract to build you a $90,000 RV, basically.
Let's talk a bit about your trailer, your essay. I think it's the last one in the book, called Shingle Wide. It's about your life in your trailer outside Moab. Probably the most personal of the essays. You kind of did look at the range of history here, from when you're a single guy, I guess, river running and et cetera, to now when you're married with a kid. So tell me first of all about this trailer. It's less than 600 square feet.
10 feet wide, 57 feet long. It's a 1963 art craft mobile home. And it's been parked on my property since, when was that? Mid-90s. And I didn't buy it until later. I rented it for quite a while before I bought it. And before I get into the details of the trailer, I'll just say that, as I mentioned earlier, when I was young, I probably didn't have the wisdom or the self-awareness to write about myself. So it wasn't until this final essay that I think I, when I was 49, 50 years old, when I was writing this, that I could finally really see myself as a young man for who I was. And so a lot of that perspective finally came into focus. And I wrote this essay during the pandemic. So my wife and we had a 9-month-old baby, and we were living in Albuquerque, teaching there at the University of New Mexico. And we came up to the trailer for spring break, and then everything was canceled. And so we decided to stay. And while we were in that trailer, I'd wake up a little bit early and I started writing, maybe just 15 or 20 minutes a day. And the idea was to write, a memoir of the past 20 years in which everything takes place in this trailer, because that's where so much of the important events of my life had taken place. And so that's where I started. And crucial to this was the fact that I was helping the original owner to remodel the trailer. And this was a friend of mine named Wendy. She was a fairly eccentric and beautiful Alaskan fisherwoman who would come to Moab to start a business. And I ended up having a huge crush on her, and she was 10 years older than me. And she brought this trailer down from, she bought it in Grand Junction and plunked it down on this lot of tumbleweeds, and then hired some local guys like myself to help her fix it up. So that's how I got to know Wendy. And she ended up pouring much more money into this and making it really sweet in a way that it wasn't when she first bought it. And so, she did the shingles on the outside, which of course, how has it got its name, the shingle wide, put in tile floors and hardwood floors, and just beautified this trailer in a way it probably wasn't meant to be. And so she ended up marrying someone else, but I ended up being her renter, and I lived there for another 5 years. And we had this great relationship that was, now that I'm married, I see that our relationship was a little bit like a marriage, and that we had this financial relationship, and we had to show up. I had to do work around the place, and in return, she cut me a deal, which allowed me to be a writer, basically, because I was paying such a small amount of rent that I was able to have time to not take a job, and I was able to work on my writing, which is where I wrote my first two books. So it became, that's the sort of saga of this trailer and this relationship I had with Wendy.
As you look back, and you said it took you until you were almost in your 50s to be able to have some clarity on your life, what it meant, who you are. Maybe compare and contrast that guy who first, helped with that trailer, moved into that trailer, and the guy who goes and still lives there on a few months of during the year with your family now.
Yeah, that's the big question, right? I mean, I think a lot of it has just been turning inward and turning towards my wife and towards my child, and seeing the purpose and the meaning and the authenticity I find there, and realizing that having dangerous solo adventures in the wilderness wasn't actually authentic to me. I mean, and for that matter, like even being a reclusive writer in this dusty old trailer and driving around in my 1965 Chevy truck, like that actually wasn't that authentic to me either, even though it had the accoutrements of authenticity. So I have grown that way. A friend of mine read this essay, and she said almost all this, it was published in Outside Magazine, and she said almost everything Outside publishes is about being away from home on an adventure. And this is an essay about domesticity. And I thought, of course, I hadn't thought about that, but I thought, that's absolutely right. This is a piece that's about finding a place and committing to it. And it's about finding a partner and committing to her and having a child and being committed to that child.
Just very briefly, you just have a couple minutes left. I imagine Moab itself has changed over time.
Yes, Moab has changed. One of the essays is specifically about the Mighty Five tourism campaign and how incredibly successful that was, how it created a kind of a monster. And if for anyone who spent time there in the 80s and 90s, it's unrecognizable. With this, I think there's built 40 or 50 hotels, and there's traffic jams, and you have to get reservations to go into Arches, and you probably have to get reservations to go to a restaurant these days. It's still, because it's such a tiny little town in such a very large wilderness, you know, you can still get out of it pretty easily. And if you live there year round, you can find the time of year when you can go into places and not be overrun by other people. But, you know, when I read other people now talking about Arches and Canyonlands, the first thing they say are like, oh, these are the most crowded, overrun national parks in the country. And that's so sad to me because, you know, I was one of the people who went to Moab because it was incredibly cheap and incredibly desolate. And it felt like no one wanted it. And so those of us who were willing to basically not have a high paying job or not pursue an ambitious career, we could just bask in the place. And it's not like that anymore. You know, people go to Moab like the way they might go to Park City and say, well, I'm going to have to get two jobs in order to afford to live here, but it's worth it because it's Moab. And that breaks my heart.
Well, we're out of time. We'll have to point you to the book to read the essay on Washington County and the Lake Powell Pipeline. Very interesting. I'll just mention here that that's, of course, Utahns know about that, but it's interesting to put this in context and kind of the broader themes of should we have cities in the desert, right? And on the other side, you talk to a county commissioner who says, I'd rather import water than export children. So some nuance to this debate. Anyway, we're out of time. I'll have to point people to the book to read that essay and the others. The book's called Delusions and Grandeur, Dreamers of the New West. Mark Sundin is the author. So Mark Sundin, once again, give us the details on this event in Moab.
I'll be in Moab at Star Hall on May 30th. I'll be speaking with Craig Childs, the author. He has a new book out, and Amy Irvine, who wrote the book Desert Cabal, also about Ed Abbey and the Moab area.
All right. We've been talking with Mark Sundin. He's author previously of The Unsettlers, The Man Who Quit Money, The Making of Toro and Car Camping. The new book is called Delusions and Grandeur, Dreamers of the New West. That's out and available now. Mark Sundin, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you, and thanks, everybody, for listening to Access Utah.
Four sets of visitors bring their emotional baggage to the Beverly Hills Hotel.
I am now going into Beverly Hills and spend every cent you got.
Marsha Mason, Bruce Davison, Amy Peetz, and Dennis Boutsakaris star in Neil Simon's California Suite, next time on LA Theater Works.
Tune in Friday night at 9 here on UPR.
You are listening to Utah Public Radio, a statewide service of Utah State University and the College of Humanities and Social Sciences. KUSR Logan, KUSK Vernal, KUSL Richfield, KUST Moab, KCEU Price, KUSU FM Logan, also heard at upr.org.